And Mr. Eccles, you're up first, and if you wish to reserve any time, let us know how much.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Micah Eccles here for appellants. This is an interstate trucking case involving the transport of an Audi vehicle. Now, interstate trucking is both highly specialized and highly regulated. The first notion we have is the Carmack Amendment in 1906, and the purpose of the Carmack Amendment isn't really given to us until we get to the Adams case from the United States Supreme Court in 1913. Adams states that we have to have a uniform law across the states in order to allow Congress to effectively regulate interstate commerce. Otherwise, we're going to have a diversity of actions, and a trucker who is going from one state to another will not know what laws apply to him. That's why the Carmack Amendment should have preempted all of plaintiff's state law claims in this case.
But, and that makes perfectly good sense, but what authority did the Knights have to take possession of this vehicle?
Now,
that's my concern, and that's the issue that the court looked to in making the determination that Carmack didn't preempt state law in this case.
Now, what I want to do, Your Honor, is make sure that we're in the same universe for review. If you look at just the motion to dismiss proceeding, which is according to Clark County School District versus Bessie, we're just looking at that closed universe. Now, at the motion to dismiss proceeding, the authority that we had was the work order with Next Day. At the time of the pretrial, there were no factual findings regarding the validity of that document. So we had the work order document from Next Day. The only way we can get the identifying information, in other words, the contact, the identity of the vehicle, was once there was a contract formed. Now, the other authority we had was the bill of lading. We also attached that to the motion to dismiss. The bill of lading was actually released to us by Desert Audi. We didn't think there was anything wrong with it. That's the initiation of, to answer your question, Your Honor. Now, our case, if you look at every preemption case, the ultimate touchstone is the purpose and the intent of Congress. And really, our case can be summed up by two statutes and two cases. The first one is 49 U.S.C. 14706. That's one of the main. That's the section that limits a liability under the Carmack Amendment. The second statute, 49 U.S.C. 13102, and specifically subsection 23B that defines transportation. And then the other two cases are Hall, a Ninth Circuit case from 2007, and Roberts, a federal district court case from Northern District of California from 2004. Let me first address the 14706. I'm specifically looking at the A1 section. In the motion to dismiss proceeding, the only argument offered by plaintiffs in opposition to Carmack preemption was that there was a lack of a direct contractual relationship between plaintiffs and Knights. There didn't need to be a direct contractual relationship. The Carmack cases, and Congress has defined the legal relationship between the parties where Knights is the carrier, plaintiffs are the shipper, and the bill of lading is the controlling document. But in previous...
How is that bill of lading generated? Can you give me a little background on that? My impression was that one of the agents for Knights had a bill of lading generated, and if that's incorrect, I need to know, because that's a mission impression on my part.
The bill of lading is generated by Knights, and the bill of lading is generated after the, in this case, Next Day legally is the broker. The broker gives Knights the information upon which we're supposed to pick the car up. Then we generate the bill of lading.
So you generate the bill of lading. There was never really a contract in this case. So you took the car, generated your own bill of lading, and you're using that to indicate that you had authority to take this vehicle and that the Carmack Amendment preempts
Correct, Your Honor. Now, it is standard in the industry that the carrier will create the bill of lading. And it was signed, it was released by Desert Audi, and it's Trial Exhibit 19, I believe, is actually signed by Desert Audi representative.
So, okay, I guess this is what's bothering me, just fundamentally. If somebody, take this hypothetically out of it, if somebody wants to go steal a vehicle, create a bill of lading that's doesn't have any basis in your authority to have possession of a vehicle, and then use that kind of as a shield, that's okay?
That's impossible to do, Your Honor, because the only way we get the identifying information from the broker is after a contract is formed. In other words, when the initial request for a work order was put on the website, all it would say was, there's a vehicle, it didn't say what kind, it's in Las Vegas, it needs to go to Ferndale, Washington.
Right, but then the contract was faxed over to Mr. Lane, I believe, and he X'd out, there was a specific request that this vehicle be closed transport. He crossed that out, and then they canceled any possible contract before you ever took possession of the vehicle.
Now, the testimony at trial was that the uncovered and covered was really a matter of preference, but wasn't a necessary condition.
Let's go back, because we're talking in terms of a motion to dismiss. If we're keeping in that tight wrap what you're trying to do, but the concern we have is that other facts have been added to this case that almost morphs it into a summary judgment situation. So the question is, what do we have? With a pure motion to dismiss, we have to keep it very narrow. It pushes us as Carmack, or do we get into a summary judgment with these other facts about the issue as to a valid bill of lading and the permission and things of that nature that we're aware of? But should we be aware of them, or should we just limit it purely to this dismissal situation, not procedural situation?
Your Honor, if we're looking at just the dismissal situation, I think that's what we have to do, because that's where Carmack was raised, dealt with, and ruled upon by the district court. Now, in my opponent's briefs, he said that that should be treated as a summary judgment hearing. I don't think it really
matters.
Were
these other facts put before the court as to the generation of the bill of lading, the issues as to permission, the issues as to contract, and those, and the other, I'll just use the term, the food fight between the parties over money not paid that got us into this situation and using the car as the pawn?
And I don't think it matters whether we look at the district court, at the dismissal proceedings. If those are treated as summary judgment, it doesn't really matter for us, for our position. Now, if you look at...
Well, Counsel, it may, because if we look at a separate judgment, it may get us far from the Carmack line that you're trying to put forth and get us into purely as state issues and not a preemption situation.
Well, the point of 14706A1 is that it says that I don't even need a bill of lading in order to remain under Carmack preemption. And so the entire discussion about the bill of lading is really irrelevant.
But Mr. Eccles, just to follow up, when my colleague said Knights would have to lawfully come into possession of the vehicle to invoke the preemption under the Carmack Amendment. Like as Justice Peregrine said, you can't go out and steal students' cars out of the UNLV parking lot and load them up and ship them to California and say, gee, it's a preemption, sorry, you're out of luck, you know, like that. So there has to be that take. And this is an absurd example, but I just want to make that point.
And actually, Your Honor, there's a situation very close to that in the Roberts case. The Roberts case is actually cited by the plaintiffs in their brief for their position. Now, what the Roberts court does is they look at 13-102-23B. That's the definition of transportation. What the definition of transportation does, it says, in the arranging for the transportation of goods. That's still considered part of transportation. So any dispute in the contract formation is still part of the entire line of Carmack preemption. Now, in the Roberts case, that was the Northern District of California, it was a class action against North American Van Lines. In the Roberts case, the court looked at a situation, the second scenario that's listed in the case. A woman's at her house, and the North American comes and gives a higher estimate than what she wants to pay. So she does not contract with them. So she leaves to go do her errands or whatever, and when she returns, all of her belongings in her house are gone. They have been packed and moved by North American. And what the court looked at is, you know, should this be preempted or not? It's kind of this bait and switch case, bait and switch scenario, which we have in both Hall and in Roberts. And what the court eventually found was it relied upon this definition of transportation in 23B. And it said, you know what? This is a preempted case by field preemption because it was intended by Congress to be included in that definition. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Larson?
Good morning, Your Honor. First thing I want to do is address the issue of the motion to dismiss and the contention that somehow the only argument raised at the motion to dismiss, which was really a motion for summary judgment, there were substantial exhibits attached to the various motion papers, did not look at the pleadings and went outside of them.
Well, it was their motion to dismiss based upon preemption, which raises another issue, whether or not that claim was waived because it wasn't pled as an affirmative defense.
It didn't become an affirmative defense until after the trial was over and a judgment was in. But they're trying to make this argument that, oh, no, this question of whether or not there was a contract was not before the trial court on the motion to dismiss. That simply is not the case. If you look at the court, the argument, trial counsel for Mr. Small specifically points to the submission by the co-defendant next day that was submitted in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And we're looking at pages, the record is page 1659 through 1672 is the argument. And next day in its opposition, which is starts at page 234 and goes through record page 242, then there was a lot of exhibits thereafter. They submitted a whole series of exhibits. At page 3 of their brief, as such, not only did next day and nights not factually enter into contract, there was never a legal meeting of the minds. Simply stated as a matter of law, Knights and next day did not have a contract for the transport of Mr. Small's vehicle. And trial counsel for Mr. Small picks up on that and makes the statement, you can look at the transcript of the hearing, and argues that there was no contract. So that was before the court. She saw that there was no contract, and that's what we were faced with at that time. That's what the court was faced with at that time. And in her decision on that, she says, based upon authority and argument of counsel. So to suggest that Mr. Small and Pacific did not, in fact, say that there wasn't a contract simply isn't accurate. They did make the argument. The court said, wait a second, I'm making a finding based upon all the arguments which included that there wasn't a contract. So at the motion to dismiss was really a motion for summary judgment, and she had evidence before her from next day in the form of deposition transcripts, documentary evidence that there was no contract. So it was an appropriate finding. Now, it was given the court and provided to counsel a couple of excerpts from the trial court's findings of fact. That's one of the items that, of course, they seek to reverse their findings of fact. And you gotta understand, essentially, to overturn a finding of fact, this court, you know, has to find that there's really no, I'll quote from the various cases, you know it all, this court will not disturb the findings of a trial court unless the findings are clearly erroneous and not based on substantial evidence. We've already said there was affidavits and information at the motion to dismiss that shows that, in fact, there wasn't a contract. Well, she made this finding, and you got a copy of this, by substantially altering the terms of the work order sent by next day to the Knights defendants. The Knights defendants created a new offer contract that was never accepted by any party to this matter. As a result, no contract exists between next day and any of the Knights defendants for transportation of the vehicle. There was no contract. The Adams case and the Carmack Amendment, they govern contracts in interstate commerce. They govern contracts the carrier has with the shipper. If there is no contract, CARMAC doesn't apply. The federal government has no right to say, if there's no contract, I can still control what happens in interstate commerce, because there was no contract. And Your Honor, I think you posed it. Does that mean someone can just come and pick up a vehicle? Yes, they can, according to Knights and their argument.
But what's important, very important thing about this finding of fact, and there's nothing in their argument to say that there isn't, that this is a manifest error, that there isn't evidence to support this. They really don't touch on this in their briefing. But she finds that the position taken by Knights was that there was a verbal contract. Now, why did they take that position? I think it's pretty obvious. You have two documents that are totally different. There couldn't have been a meeting of minds with those two documents as marked up. So therefore, there was a verbal contract. But she says, they offered no credible evidence of a verbal contract. They, being the president of Knight and Michelle Cunning and Mr. Lane, the fellow who supposedly was engaged in this contractual arrangement. And then the court had a couple of other specific findings that are not even addressed in the appeal, were challenged by Knight. The court found the testimony of Michelle Cunning to be both unreliable and lacking credibility. This court also makes a specific finding that Mr. Lane lacked credibility as a witness.
Those findings of credibility are supposed to be given special deference by the court, by this court, when a trial court makes those findings. And that deference should be there. I'm not saying it's impossible for the court, but the trial court sees the demeanor, watches the witnesses, see how they testify. And going all the way back to 1899 to the current time frame, the case law is replete with a statement of the regard and the deference that this court should give to that finding. And her finding that there are not reliable and credible witnesses is a basis, to a great extent, for her finding that there was no contract.
What about the argument this is a field preemption case and that therefore we shouldn't even look to whether or not there was a contract?
Well, it's not a field preemption case if there's no contract. Under their theory, a trucker can run all around the country creating their own bill of lading.
What if there was a mistaken belief there was a contract?
There wasn't a mistaken belief. There was not a mistaken belief there was a contract.
No, not in this case. I'm saying generally.
I guess if there was a mistaken belief, legitimate concern, then the question was there or not a meeting of the minds. But in this case, we have something totally different. And I think that's the key difference here to any sort of argument like that. And listen, they knew there was a problem, okay? Recall that when Mr. Little showed up to pick up the vehicle, he had a bill of lading. And he had created that bill of lading. And he put the vehicle on the truck. And then the auto dealer came out and said, take it off the truck. Please take it off the truck. And he didn't sit down and talk with him, say, what's the problem? What's the issue? I've got a contract. He called dispatch first. And this is at page 1868 to 1869 of the record. He called dispatch. Who's dispatch? The court is questioning him at these pages. How come he didn't take it off if they asked you to take it off? Because they told me to go when I called my dispatcher. So the court goes on. So you ignored him, referring to the Audi person. Well, I called dispatch first. Who's dispatch? Bruce Lane? I called Bruce. And he told you, the witness, and told him what was going on. The court, to ignore the request? Witness, yes. The court, yes. So when the representative went back inside Desert Audi, you left. The witness, I left, yes. The court, you didn't tell him I'm going to ignore the request? I'm going to take this vehicle off? I didn't know. The court, you didn't give an opportunity to discuss this with you? There was no dialogue with him after that point. Why did he take off like that? Why didn't you discuss it with him? Why didn't you try to find out what the problem was? Maybe it was just the fact it was an open carrier and Desert Audi knew that it was going to be should be a closed carrier. Whatever the issue was, he took off and Bruce Lane told him to take off. And what we know from the record is that starting that day on the 28th of June, it was not about the delivery of Mr. Small's vehicle. This whole thing was about a separate dispute. Is the evidence is really irrefutable, quite frankly, particularly based on the court's finding that there was no contract. Mr. McGee, there is substantial evidence to support the court's finding there was no contract. Mr. McGee, the president of NextDay, testified that there was no contract. He testified about the cancellation, testified about the fact that they didn't respond within 30 minutes. There was no agreement. And actually, there's testimony another truck showing up. Mr. Small talks about another truck showing up later that day, and that's when everything really got confusing. But the fact of the matter is, there was no contract, plain and simple. And the suggestion that, well, they only would have had the VIN, they only would have had the VIN if they had a contract in place. So they had to have the VIN, supposedly. There must have been a contract for the VIN before they showed up. Well, problem is, there's VIN information on the transmittal documents that went back and forth. Exhibit 20 is the document.
I think they were saying the pickup and delivery information, unless they would have had that.
Right.
They wouldn't have had that but for a contract and a bill of lading that should have been generated.
But if we look at the two documents, the pickup and delivery information is on Exhibit 20, which is the transmittal from NextDay. It shows that, and it says sign it, send it back, and give us the information about the driver, give us his cell phone number. The testimony from Mr. Lane is clear. He crossed it all up, he changed it all, so there wasn't a meeting of the minds. That's what the court found. And no doubt, and Mr. Lane testified that the truck was picked up before he got the documents. That was his testimony, that before he got the documents, the truck had picked up the vehicle. Now, he's saying that, I think, because if he says, I had the documents and we were going back and forth, he's saying there was no meeting of the minds. He was trying to support his theory that there was some type of verbal agreement. And he says, so we picked it up first. And then,
they're
and then
also,
I got it.
Contesting the damage award itself, indicating there wasn't a set off for the $40,000 that was paid pre-trial. And I guess your position is, while it was a $67,000 car, they paid $40,000 pre-trial. That left a balance here, and then the $25,000
comes in
for loss of use, plus the $300,000 for punitive.
Correct. And very quickly on that, their numbers in the brief don't work out, because even if you knock out the $25,000,
well, there's about $250 a mistake.
Right, right.
To their benefit.
But also they say you should give us the $40,000 credit. It comes out at $12,500. Well, you already got the $40,000 credit. If you disregard the loss of use, then you have $67,253 less the $40,000. So you're at $27,000, okay? $27,000 plus. And we cite in our brief that there is case law very clearly that you can obtain loss of use in Nevada in addition to the value of the car.
Now, the loss of use amount was about $35 a day,
right,
what the court did. How was that number arrived at?
That number was a number actually in the NextDay work order, which says that there's a $35 a day charge if it's late for rental. So that's what Mr. Small took. He testified in court. I took the $35 a day from the documents from NextDay. I thought that was reasonable. It was essentially
a $67,000 car. Would he be entitled to seek more in loss of use damages?
Well, quite frankly, if I could rent a $67,000 car for $35 a day, I would do it every time I went out of town. I usually get that Ford Taurus for about $40 a day.
What about Mr. Larson? What about the $300,000 in punitives? Was there evidence maliciousness and all the conduct of Knights and all to justify an award of punitive damages?
Well, the testimony from Mr. Athan of the dealer, from Mr. McGee, and from Mr. Small all was that I'm not giving you your car back till NextDay pays their bill. They wouldn't, Mr. Small testified.
This was an accumulated bill that they'd owed for unrelated transactions,
right,
for a period of time.
It had nothing to do with Mr. Small. They were using Mr. Small's vehicle as hostage, held hostage, or for ransom. That was a testimony from Mr. Athan. One of those terms was used. He's the Audi dealer guy saying, that's what I was told by Mr. Lane. Mr. McGee said that's what his company was told by Mr. Lane. Mr. Small said that's what he was told by Mr. Lane. And they didn't deliver it. They didn't tell him where it was. He got conflicting stories, Mr. Small did. At one point he said next they had it, Lane told him next they had it down in Arizona. So he had a whole series of conflicting stories. They wouldn't give him his vehicle. He got a lawyer. He gave him a limit of July 13th, get me the vehicle back. They wouldn't do it. And then all of a sudden he's saying, well, we don't want to deliver it. But they were playing a game. They said, guess what? We're a big corporation. We got lots of money. We're dealing with an individual out here. We'll have him press these other folks. It's corporate extortion, quite frankly, by these folks. And I think also the court found the testimony of their president and key man, Mr. Lane, to be so unreliable at trial. I think that, quite frankly, it showed their whole course of conduct would be to do anything to get the money from Next Day through poor Mr. Small, who didn't have his vehicle.
Before you sit down, one of the key points, so we're still playing with whether Carmack comes into play or not, is that was the allowance of the amendment to the complaint, or the answer, as to allowing the affirmative defense.
Well, Your Honor, we have a cross appeal on that, and I really don't think you need to reach that, because if there was no contract, if there was a theft before there was interstate commerce, if there was no contract to be controlled by the Carmack Amendment, then Carmack isn't in place. And I think, in effect, what the court did is it said, you can have your affirmative defense. I didn't believe it, okay, in essence of what I think she said. But certainly, I think, given the fact that she said, no, the Carmack doesn't apply in her ruling on the motion to dismiss prior to trial, then Mr. Small goes in to try the case. And Carmack, you know, maybe it's there in the periphery somewhere up in the air, but he doesn't have to focus on issues of Carmack. He doesn't have to argue those issues. He doesn't have to even think about Carmack, because she said it's not applying the case, and now all of a sudden there's an affirmative defense associated with it. So I think the judge did a great job in this case. Okay, I don't want to say she did anything wrong, except I think probably that was technically an abuse of discretion.
And that is the, as you're articulating now, that tends to be the mud in the water. We had a motion to dismiss, the court ruled on it, now we have a trial, we have all these other facts, we're now commingling this motion to dismiss and the trial, and the question is, what clearly was before the court at the time of the motion to dismiss, well, and going back to that order?
And I say, look at the pleadings of the motion to dismiss, look at the filings by the Next Day, who said there wasn't a contract, and look at the argument, which the court considered, where counsel for Mr. Small clearly said, there is no contract, the Carmack doesn't apply, this was a theft. And she had enough before her to see that.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate your time.
Mr. Ruckel?
Your Honors, what I want to do in my rebuttal argument is assume for the fact of this appeal that the fraud claim and the conversion claim were supported as the district court found. I don't want to get into the substantial evidence argument, but what I want to do is say if we take that at face value, and I know we have the commingling problem of motion to dismiss hearing versus the trial hearing, and I think that's largely due because the answering brief superimposed a lot of the trial stuff back, but the commingling issue aside as well, if we just say this in the words counsel used, and I think was also in the district judge's written order, they held this car for ransom. Let's just assume that that's true. If you look at the Hall case was also a case where the household goods were held for ransom. There was a larger amount requested. Now, what the court says, we don't care if the goods were held for ransom. Hall actually involved two common law claims for fraud and conversion. And what the court did is, in Hall, is said, you know what? In order to look at whether the Carmack preemption applies, we have to look at the subject matter of what's being shipped. If it is actually the transit, the goods in transit, then the Carmack preemption does apply. The contract issue that they've raised really doesn't matter, as we've stated in the definition of 14, 706. Now, another thing that the Hall Court did is it explained why there was Carmack preemption of fraud and conversion. What the court did is said, you know what, when we're talking about loss or damage of goods in transit, we're going to also add to that plain meaning delay, failure to deliver altogether, and the failure to deliver altogether was based upon United States Supreme Court. That was the Blish Milling case. Mistaken deliveries, these are the kind of nuances that Adams expressed foresaw that the court didn't want to get involved in to take the uniformity of laws out of preemption.
But again, weren't those cases where there were contracts, there was contracts with the shipper and the interstate carrier?
Now, in Hall, there was a contract. It was a direct relationship. In Roberts, there was no contract in that second scenario that I brought up. And in our case, there wouldn't have been a contract because we dealt with the broker dealt with the plaintiffs. That's the reason that the bill of lading controls instead of a direct contract.
Let me ask a question because I'm sitting here at this point saying that if your position is correct, that the motion to dismiss should have been granted, but since the court didn't, and it appears that the court let you go forward and assert Carmack issues at time of trial, should the court then look at the trial as your opportunity to show that Carmack was valid or invalid? So you had your, in essence, day in court on that issue, and the court made its ruling even though you don't agree in terms of whether or not Carmack was applicable based upon the facts in this case.
Well, Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, the way we treated Carmack, it was dealt with completely in the motion to dismiss, was not dealt with at trial.
But you were allowed to amend for purposes of trial your affirmative defense as to Carmack. So I can't throw it away. You put it back on the table. So you had it at the trial. And the information was added at that time.
The only reason we amended our answer to include Carmack was to relate back to the motion to dismiss hearing. And the reason we did that, because in their opposition, they raised a waiver question. And the district judge's ruling on the motion to dismiss was a little bit unclear because she didn't give a reasoning. And so under NRCP 15B, I thought, well, we've raised it, we've preserved it, I don't think there's a problem. But just to make sure that the court wasn't ruling on the waiver when she says, I don't think it applies, I want to make sure that of that. And under Rule 15B, I don't have to amend, but we did just to make sure that she wasn't ruling on the waiver. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer those.
No, I think that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank the parties for this argument. A lot more was gleaned today than we had gleaned previously, and it created probably more questions than answers, so we're going to be digging deeper. Folks who were treated to very good arguments, folks did their homework before coming to us this day. This matter will stand submitted.